Chapter 14, Part 2. Margaret and I got together later in the week for my practical training. In the four-hour session, she taught me how to take a pulse, measure blood pressure and respiration, and do the Heimlich maneuver. I also watched a couple of hours of aides properly taking care of patients, explaining every move they made. At the end of the 4 hours, Margaret declared, "Mr. Tidyman, you are ready." I scheduled the test for the next available date. 2 months later, I had my test date mailed to me. My presence was requested in Jacksonville. 20 of us showed up. At least 5 of the applicants were there for retesting. Not a good sign. Within the first 10 minutes, the written tests were passed out. This test proved to be no different from or less ridiculous than the one from the Internet. I passed. For the practical portion, we were called into a room, 2 at a time, with a registered nurse as a test facilitator, along with the test mannequin, Rugged Rhonda, who subbed as the patient in bed. Each applicant was given 3 patient-related tasks out of 20 for the practical test, such as measuring blood pressure, making up the bed with the patient in it, or using the Hoyer lift. I knew right away that unless I got 3 really easy tasks, I would be back there in 2 months retesting. But that's just what I got, 3 of the easiest. The things I had to do had to be performed on a live person, in this case, the other applicant. I had to brush her teeth, measure her height and weight, and check her temperature. No, not anally. In short, I passed. I normally don't believe in luck, but this qualifying test really tested my belief system. For what it was worth, I was now ready and licensed and ready to provide professional caregiving service within a 30-mile radius of my home. In the last 50 years, when I became part of a new workforce, an employer might say, "Hey, you, we start at 8. Or, "Welcome aboard, Jim, get to work." Some of the feelings expressed after I had been on the job for a week, a month, or a year have gone from, "You're shitting me, Tidyman, what the fuck were you thinking?" to, "Jim, you do great work, we're glad you're part of the team." However, shortly after I became a CNA, my presence began to be ascribed to the goodness of God. Since I am not a believer in the Christian interpretation of God, I always found this sentiment from my clients to be heartfelt, humorous, interesting, and much appreciated. They'd say things like, "We thank God every day for sending you to us," or, "God found you and directed you to us," or just, "Thank God you're here to help us." Naturally, I didn't think God had anything to do with this latest employment. The profession just happened to appeal to my personality as a people pleaser and was suited to my physical limitations. For instance, I was good for short bursts of energy, but overall, I was a physical wreck. What with the congestive heart failure, being overweight, having arthritic knees, tennis elbow, tinnitus, and now and then a bout of sciatica, it was a wonder I could do anything. However, it was me, not God, who may have had something to do with my present condition. In the past, I had drunk way too much alcohol, probably damaging my heart. The arthritis that developed in my knees may have been aggravated from the motorcycle accident in 1975 when I severely broke my left leg, leaving it an inch shorter than my right. Then, in 1986, I had torn the cartilage in my knees from a bad landing while parachuting in Kansas. Combine that with my excess weight and age, and you end up like me. Not too good for anything else other than a low-impact gig like being a CNA. Don't misunderstand. I enjoyed the work. Except for my clients thinking that I was a gift from God, I loved their constant appreciation for the help I gave. I usually walked away from a shift feeling better emotionally than I did when I got there. Before I would quit for the day, they would usually tell me how much they were looking forward to my return. What other professions, in which you directly administer to people suffering, would you put in that glorified light? Okay, your computer repair tech or your DUI lawyer. I may have mentioned before that my people-pleasing personality was developed as a coping strategy when I was growing up in a fairly dysfunctional family. Regardless of how it developed, it's real. I like pleasing people. I found that with CNA work, I have a lot of natural compassion for my clients. I am truly sorry that they cannot do more for themselves, and I feel great when I can help them and can anticipate their needs. Okay, not all of their needs. As a CNA, I was also called upon to take care of the dark side of healthcare, the bathroom. No need to go into details. Suffice it to say that when it came to such issues, I have done it all. When I talked to my family or friends, I told them that there are only two types of clients. Those who can pee and poop by themselves, which I call the Cadillac standard, and the rest. I didn't care what else was ailing them. If they could go to the bathroom unassisted, I wished them a long and happy life. Fortunately, 9 out of 10 of my clients met the Cadillac standard. When I drove a cab in Westlake, Ohio, I had the mistaken notion that I would run into a lot of interesting characters. I did not. When I was a CNA, the opposite was true. I ran into and took care of a host of interesting and lovable characters. Every once in a while, I would have to take care of a worthless, mean-spirited prick who refused to die. But that wasn't often. Ken was my most famous client. In his youth, he had been a tall, strapping, good-looking guy, and he carried those good looks into his dotage. He loved to laugh and tell stories, and so did I. Conversations with Ken didn't last long, since just getting up and walking to the kitchen tuckered him out. I didn't know what was wrong with Ken, other than he was really old. He was not an alcoholic, but certainly enjoyed his vodka and orange juice. At least he did when I took care of him. And being the gentleman drinker that he was, he would insist that I have a drink with him every time I was there. Ken was a Cadillac standard client. He told great stories, insisting that a story wasn't a story unless we could raise a toast to it at the end. I'm sure he made that tradition up. By all rights, I was absolutely forbidden by caregivers to indulge in any kind of alcoholic beverages while on duty. I told this to Ken when he first offered. He said, "Jim, first of all, I'm not going to say a word to anyone. And," he continued, looking slightly offended, "are you telling me you're not going to have a drink with me?" Naturally, I could and should have said, "Sorry, Ken, but those are the rules." Just thinking about saying those words sounded stupid to me. I figured if there was anything I could do to make a patient's limited time on Earth more enjoyable, screw the rules. We shared many drinks. When I saw Ken, and that was a few times a week, our routine went like this. Ken got out of bed, and we shared a screwdriver. I made his dinner and listened to his stories. If necessary, we shared another screwdriver. Ken said he was a boyhood friend of President John F. Kennedy's. He was also the youngest car dealership owner in Florida, a bush pilot, a pilot in World War II, a war correspondent, an Alaskan homesteader, an author, a husband, a father of three, and a dog lover. He wrote the book, The Race to Nome, considered by many to be the inspiration for the Iditarod dog sled race. After listening to Ken's stories for a few hours, I would feel as though I hadn't done anything with my life. I'm sure much of what he told me was true. I saw plenty of it documented in newspaper articles. I alternated shifts taking care of Ken with Lisa, another CNA from caregivers. Ken loved and trusted her. She had been with him for a year and a half. Lisa was pleasant enough. We exchanged hellos and goodbyes at shift change. She was a born-again Christian who carried her Bible with her everywhere she went. I feared getting snagged into a conversation with her. I wasn't quite ready to be saved. One day, after she left, Ken asked me to look at a letter he got from a collection agency. His concern was that the agency's attempt to collect past due bills for $1,200 on a credit card he didn't think he owned. One call to the collection agency confirmed that Ken did in fact have this credit card. My call to MasterCard further showed that Ken's card had paid rent, bought groceries, and paid one plumbing bill, all for Lisa. She had used Ken's Social Security number, birth date, and address to obtain a new credit card in his name for herself. Praise the Lord. Once again, I was dismayed at how readily caregivers hired me. Taking advantage of someone's trust is easy enough to do. It's child's play if the person you're bilking has one foot in a grave and the other on a banana peel. Lisa was not prosecuted, but she was terminated. Ken was mighty disappointed. Ken died of natural causes 6 months after I started working with him. Although I had more patience with caregivers than I'll mention in this memoir, Lewis turned out to be my last patient with them before I started freelancing. Lewis most certainly should have been in a nursing home, where the care for him would have been better than what a handful of CNAs could provide. The day I started with him, his wife was taken to the hospital, complaining of weakness. She died a week later. I suspect she died of exhaustion from taking care of Lewis, a situation that happens all too often with caregivers. The only piece of handicap health care equipment in this house was an electric wheelchair. Lewis no longer had use of his legs. He looked like a large catfish with horn-rimmed glasses. His good-sized pot belly and ass barely fit between the armrests of his wheelchair. Except for a few tufts of gray hair, he was bald. The caregiving routine with Lewis started around 7 a.m. I woke him up, he switched on the television, and lay around for an hour, my nap time. At 8, he yelled for his breakfast. I'd crank the bed up so he's in a sitting position. He wanted his plate or bowl of food balanced on his gut. This turned out to be a pretty stable tray table. After he ate, he took another short nap. So did I. At 9, he yelled, "I'm ready." That meant he was ready for his bedpan. A few minutes later, he'd yell again, "I'm ready." Then came dressing him, which was not as difficult as it sounds. Now came the fun part. Rolling his considerable ass out of bed and into the wheelchair. He knew he was a pile of fat, dead weight. In fact, he kind of reminded me of Rugged Ron from the fire department, only Rugged Ron was significantly better looking and much easier to get along with. Lewis was proud of himself for coming up with a transferring procedure he thought would demand the least amount of strain and strength from both of us. He was wrong. What he came up with was a convoluted dance of twists and turns accompanied with grunts and his yelling at me, "God damn it, can't you get it right?" Of course, he always ended up in his chair, but it was a workout and a half, and I was not in the best of shape. I tried to suggest a better way of moving him, but he wouldn't hear of it. When I first started working with Lewis, it was an 8-hour shift. The first 2 hours wiped me out for the day. I'm sure my heart condition had something to do with that. After 3 weeks, the agency asked me to start pulling a 12-hour shift. I tried it for 2 days. It was more than I could handle. First, I didn't like the guy. Secondly, he should have arranged to get a Hoyer lift. Third, I had a weak heart. And fourth, I didn't like the guy. I told caregivers that the best I could do was work a 6-hour shift. They tried it for a week and then called and told me I had to go back to 12. No thanks. So that was it for me, with Lewis and caregivers. All the while I was working for caregivers, I was also working at the same time for myself as a CNA. I ended up taking a big cut in pay by quitting caregivers, but now I had a lot of time to devote to marketing, and we all know how good I am at that. I starved for the first 6 months, but was eventually able to build up enough clients to keep me whole. Joe was my only black patient. He was a little guy with a shaved head. He was a slow walker and a slow talker. By the time I got to him, he was pretty tuckered out. He was in his late 70s and had, among other ailments, a form of necrosis in his legs. Naturally, he didn't move too fast. My duties consisted of the morning meet and greet, during which I helped him get dressed, shaved his face and head, and made him breakfast. Sometimes he ate at home. More often, we went to McDonald's for a pancake and sausage breakfast. Then we ran his errands or visited his doctors. Joe was very friendly and talkative, the latter being a bit of a problem, since I could understand only 60% of what he said. He talked softly, had a southern accent, and was hard of hearing. I've also got tinnitus, which makes me hard of hearing. We were a great pair. With all of my hard of hearing clients, I talked very loudly and clearly. In fact, one client told me he thought he was cured of his hearing problem after spending the day with me. He was upset when he got home one night and couldn't hear a word his wife said. Joe had this goofy little phrase he used all the time, where it's concerned. For instance, he'd say, "You know, I was talking to my son the other day, where it's concerned, and he said not for me to worry about it." Or, "When we go to see the doctor today, where it's concerned, you know, with my pills and all, see what you can find out." It reminded me of Ken in Georgia. "Well, Toddeman, you know the fact of business is, we ain't got enough nails." I worked with Joe for a year, more as a companion and a chauffeur than anything else. His list of ailments finally took their toll. He died shortly after being admitted to a nursing home. I also worked with Lee for a year before prostate cancer took him. Lee and his wife, Elizabeth, were Laurel and Hardy fans, even belonging to the Sons of the Desert Club, a Laurel and Hardy fan club. Lee had a great sense of humor, could sing hundreds of short ditties, and when he was feeling up to it, told great jokes. Naturally, we got along fine. I credit Lee with one of my now favorite jokes. It's a coffee lover's joke. Seems there was this really mouthy jerk in a bar getting louder and more obnoxious by the minute. The bartender finally throws him out. Unfortunately, a few of the pissed-off patrons follow him out to the parking lot and beat the snot out of him. They break his ribs, his nose, his jaw, and leave him unconscious. The next day, Mr. Smith wakes up in the hospital, groggy, jaw-wired, and really out of it. The nurse comes in and says, "Oh, I'm so glad you're awake, Mr. Smith. Looks like you took quite a beating last night. We've already given you as many painkillers as we can, but is there anything else I can get you?" Mr. Smith thinks about it for a second and says through the pain, wired jaw, and gritted teeth, "Yes, I want some coffee." The nurse says, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, but with your mouth wired shut, there isn't any way I could get any coffee into you."
"Please, I just want some coffee."
The nurse thinks about it and says, "I suppose there is one way we could get it into you and still have a little effect, but you're not going to like it."
"What is it?"
"Well, I'm afraid we'd have to give it to you as an enema."
"Oh, shit. Okay, give it to me."
The nurse prepares the coffee and enema. She comes back into the room, turns Mr. Smith over, and starts to administer the coffee. A few seconds later, Mr. Smith screams. Alarmed, the nurse stops and says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, was it too hot?"
"No," she says, "too sweet."
Another client, Philip, was one of the nicest guys I had ever met. He was always glad to see me. Unfortunately, because of Alzheimer's, he never had any idea who I was. My job was just to sit with him while his wife took off for a 4 or 5 hour break. As soon as his wife left, I'd lock the front door behind her. We still had access to the rest of the home and the Adirondack chairs right on the edge of their riverfront property. Whether it was sitting there watching the river or watching TV in the sunroom, we'd carry on conversations for hours. He didn't make a lick of sense, but this did not prevent him from talking and laughing about everything mostly imagined. His train of thought never went beyond one sentence on one subject. I discovered that I could converse with him effortlessly and endlessly, a skill I picked up when I was married. Eventually, because of safety issues, Phil had to be moved to a nursing home. John, another client, was a 77-year-old, mostly bedridden MS victim. I saw John once or twice a month, so his wife could take off for the day with her girlfriends. He was a retired college math professor who looked a little like Bob Newhart. John wanted to let me know right away that he taught mathematics, not arithmetic. In addition to being really smart and very affable, he was very knowledgeable on a number of subjects. During the 10 hours I was with John, 80% of the time was spent sitting and talking. He was very knowledgeable, but I'd been around the block once or twice myself. The first few times I was with him, he'd preface a subject by saying, "I bet you didn't know this, but..." I started to get a little annoyed, since 8 out of 10 times I did know what he was talking about. One day I finally said to him, "John, how about every time you introduce a new subject, you assume I'm not ignorant and preface it by saying, 'Jim, you probably know this.'" It was smooth sailing after that. Paul was another referral from the caregivers group. By the time I hooked up with him, his wife of 67 years, Lois, was in a nursing home recovering from a broken leg. She had fallen in their house. Although she was slowly recovering, it was obvious to everyone except Paul that Lois would probably not be able to come home again. Aside from the long healing process, her dementia was increasing. I think I was the first caregiver Paul's daughter, Paula, had hired. Paul had arthritis, back problems, and hearing loss, as well as short-term memory loss. When Paula introduced me, he didn't know quite what to make of it. Paula told him that I was coming by a few times a week to give him a hand now and then, now that Lois was in the nursing home. He grudgingly agreed. Within the first 2 weeks, Paul accepted me as his new friend. Most times, he didn't comprehend that I was getting paid for it. Paul's wife passed away a year after I started seeing him, but until then, almost every time I worked with him, I took him to visit her. We'd pack a few snacks for her, jump in the car, and head 5 miles down the road to the nursing home. Although Lois's dementia was getting worse, she never failed to recognize Paul. She had amazing eyesight, and the memory of her husband never left her. She would be at one end of the corridor, 200 feet away. As soon as Paul rounded the corner, she'd spot Paul and let out a howl of recognition. The first time I brought Paul to the nursing home for a visit with Lois, I stayed in the room with them. That didn't last. Although she was glad to see him, and vice versa, her dementia had her talking in circles. His hearing loss had him answering in circles. They were together for an hour and made as much sense as the conversations I had with my other patient, Phil. So the next time, and every time after that, I'd get them set up in the room, knees to knees, snacks within reach, and then head down to the hall while they visited. After an hour, they both were so worn out from trying to communicate that they were glad to part until the next visit. After Lois passed away, Paula moved her dad into an assisted living facility. Paul was of Norwegian descent, a decorated World War II veteran, 89, and still in remarkably good shape. He had a beautiful, full head of silver hair. It wouldn't surprise me if he lived to be 100. After a year with him, we were hard and fast friends. I saw him 3 times a week. On weekdays, we spent the afternoons playing checkers and dominoes. I drove him to the doctor, ran errands with him, and went grocery shopping. We bought lottery tickets, drove on the beach to feed the seagulls, or did anything else we could think of or wanted to. Of late, we had been going to the Saturday dog races. I had to shout everything I said to Paul. It was tiring. The main reason we didn't have a conversation that lasted more than a few sentences was that I would get tired of yelling everything. He refused to get a hearing aid. He said that with a hearing aid, you can hear everything. He found that concept annoying. He thought he was funny. I yelled at him one day that I wish he'd get a hearing aid. No thanks, he said. I don't drink red wine. Paul was still alive and well in Florida when I left. Then there was Betty. I wonder if she's still alive. I wouldn't be surprised if she and her cat went up in a ball of fire. Betty, who had a lovely southern drawl, was an 80-year-old narcoleptic chain smoker with a penchant for younger men. I didn't discover that last part until I started working with her. After my interview with Joanna, her daughter, I was hired to come in 3 times a week in the evening to spend 4 hours with Betty. I would help with her evening meal and keep her company until she went to bed. Joanna wanted to know if I minded that her mother smoked. I hate the smell of cigarette smoke. I hate how the stench sticks to your clothes, the furniture, and your breath. On the other hand, I needed the money. I told Joanna I didn't mind at all. My first and last night there started with getting the grand tour of the house with the mother and daughter. After Joanna left, I spent a few minutes talking to Betty while getting her dinner ready. It was a simple affair of leftover meatloaf, mashed potatoes, salad, and apple pie. While I was doing this, Betty sat at the kitchen table, smoking and telling me, among other things, how much she appreciated me being there. I served dinner, and we commenced to eat. Between forkfuls of mashed potatoes, Betty asked, "Do you like to watch old movies? Because if you do, there's a..." And that's when her chin hit her chest and she fell asleep. I had never been around anyone with narcolepsy. I was surprised and fascinated at the same time. I had seen plenty of people nod off to sleep from exhaustion or pass out from too much to drink or from one of my endless stories. But I had never seen anyone suddenly drop off to sleep, sitting up, in the middle of dinner, in the middle of a sentence. I reached over and touched her arm to wake her up, which she did as quickly as she fell asleep. Embarrassed, she'd say, "Oh, jeez, I hate it when that happens. Most of the time, I get all the way through." Her chin dropped to her chest again. This happened a few more times before she finished dinner. After dinner, we headed to the living room. She wanted a smoke. She lit up and filled the silence between us with stories about her children. While she talked, I noticed 2 really long cigarette burn stains on the obviously inflammable carpet. As she put out her cigarette, she nodded off again. This time I let her sleep. Unfortunately, it only lasted 3 minutes. Betty said she had some questions about her email account. We put the laptop on the dining room table and sat next to each other. As I started to show her some basic email stuff, I felt something rubbing my leg. When I looked under the table, I saw that Betty had her shoe off and was rubbing my leg with her foot. I quickly slid my chair back and exclaimed, "Excuse me, Betty, what are you doing?" In that slow southern drawl, she asked, "Why, whatever do you mean?" "What I mean is that I do not want you rubbing my leg with your foot." "Why not?" "Well, first of all, it's not appropriate. Secondly, I just don't want you doing it."
"But doesn't it feel good? I mean, I'm just rubbing your leg a bit. What's the big deal?"
"I'm not going to sit here and argue the point. Please stop doing it."
"Okay, but I don't see what the problem is."
She spent the next 2 hours smoking, nodding off to sleep, dropping long tubes of ashes on the floor, watching him moving and nodding off to sleep, until she finally decided it was time for her to hit the sack. That was my signal to leave. I called Joanne the next day to let her know that she would be better off with a female caregiver. I did not mention the wisdom of upping her homeowner's insurance. My last clients were Jim and his wife, Donna. Jim used to be built like a linebacker, but by the time I got to him, he weighed 135. Even at this point, he was a sharp dresser. He also had a wry sense of humor and an insatiable thirst for everything. He had a long and successful career as an insurance broker for State Farm, raised a bunch of children, and doted on a few grandchildren. I didn't know it until a little later, but he was slowly dying from cancer. Jim was one half of a great love story. Donna, the other half, was in great shape except for the stroke she had suffered 4 years into their 45-year marriage. I've seen spouses walk away from marriages for a lot less than that. Donna's stroke had slowed her speech considerably and caused her to lose most of her motor skills from toes to fingertips on her right side. It took incredible strength and courage on her part to go through a lifetime of rehabilitation. It took a truckload of patience and love for Jim to stick by her, which he did. In my year and a half working with both of them, I saw countless travel shots of them together. This was long after Donna's stroke. The level of joy expressed in the photos wasn't fake. The same devotion was there when I worked for them. It was almost a contest to see which one could cater more to the other. My work for them consisted of preparing their meals, driving them around, and occasionally walking their painfully cute dog, a Westie named Annie. Jim had celiac disease, requiring him to eat a gluten-free diet. Donna always ate what Jim had. Making gluten-free meals taste good was a fun challenge. When I arrived on the scene, Donna was in a rehab hospital recovering from a broken hip. Every day I was with Jim, it included a drive to the hospital for an hour visit with Donna. Although the work was relatively easy, when Donna was released from the hospital, I continued to work for both of them, and that cute little dog, Annie. Annie had a tendency to bark all the time for no reason that I could discern. It drove me nuts, but I hardly ever showed it. The amount of love and devotion Jim and Donna showered on Annie made me think twice about voicing my opinion. I did wonder, on more than one occasion, how far I could throw her out into the Atlantic Ocean, how long it would take her to swim back, and whether that would have deterred her barking. I know a snout full of salt water always quieted me down. Anyhow, I never got the chance to find out. I'm sure that Annie is still alive and barking her ass off. It's just that I am no longer there to hear it. 2 months before he died, Jim purchased a fully equipped handicap conversion van with all the bells and whistles. He wanted to make sure that after he was gone, Donna was going to have as much independence and ease as any able-bodied person would. The rest of the time I worked with Donna, I spent a couple of hours each visit teaching her to drive it and master the controls. She was a quick learner. I went to Jim's funeral. I was asked to say a few words. I was glad to. Aside from talking about what a great person he was, I wanted to recount Jim's favorite joke. I thought he would really appreciate it, and I thought his family and friends would also. Seems there was an insurance agency in a strip mall that needed to hire an extra secretary. The boss instructed his current secretary to put a sign in the window advertising the position. He told her to make sure it read, "Help wanted, 40 words per minute typing, computer literate, bilingual, and equal opportunity employer." An hour later, a small dog came by and started scratching at the sign and pawing at the window. The secretary let the dog in and asked, "What is it, little doggy? You want a job?" The little dog jumped onto the windowsill and started whining and scratching at the back of the sign. The secretary called her boss out and said, "Look, isn't that cute? I think the little doggy wants a job." The insurance agent went along with it and said to the little dog, "I can't hire you. You're a dog. Besides, you have to know how to type." With that, the little dog jumped into the secretary's desk chair, swung around to the typewriter, and started pounding out a great business letter. The agent is stunned, but still doesn't give in. He said, "That's great, but you're still a dog, and besides, you have to be computer literate." Now the dog swung around on the chair to face the computer and started putting together an intricate spreadsheet. The agent is amazed, but still wouldn't budge. "Look," he says, "I can't hire you. You're a dog." The dog jumped down from the chair and then up to the windowsill and put his paw right on the words, "Equal Opportunity Employer." The agent said, "Yeah, all right, you got a point. But last but not least, you got to be bilingual." That's when the dog looked up at him and said, "Meow." I worked with Donna for 6 months after her husband died.